Since the Berlin Wall fell some 30 years ago, much has happened in the formerly communist countries. In general, those countries that pursued the fastest, most comprehensive reform achieved the best results in terms of growth, improvements in living standards, and stronger institutions. Reform laggards like Russia or Belarus or Ukraine performed poorly by many measures, including civil and political rights. I consider Central Europe and the Baltics to be largely a success story. The region implemented far-reaching economic and political liberalization at the same time to create market democracies in a very short period of time. This included reform stars like Estonia, Poland, and the Czech Republic. But in recent years, we've also seen the rise of populist and nationalist politics, not just among reform laggards, but also in Central European countries like Poland and Hungary, and indeed in Western Europe itself, making it a serious political issue for the European Union. This too represents a sort of transition, only not one that is a transition from socialism to the market, but rather one that moves countries away from greater economic and other freedoms. Understanding these transitions is a challenge for all of us, especially so for advocates of liberal democracy. That's why I'm pleased to be able to host today one of the most insightful observers of and one of the most consequential participants in the great changes that have gone over, that have shaped Europe in the past several decades. Leszek Balcerowicz was a deputy prime minister and finance minister of Poland when the Soviet bloc fell, and under his leadership, Poland became the first radical reformer in the region among the ex-socialist countries, putting the nation on a path toward growth and political stability. He has since served in those positions in the late 1990s and subsequently as the head of the central bank, where his policies were largely responsible for Poland being the only country in the EU to avoid the 2009 recession. Because of his contributions to freedom in Poland and beyond, the Cato Institute awarded Dr. Balcerowicz the Milton Friedman Prize for Advancing Liberty in the year 2014. He is currently a professor at the Warsaw School of Economics. He heads the think tank on civil reform and is a prominent liberal voice in Poland's public policy debate. Please help me welcome Professor Leszek Balcerowicz.
Thank you very much. In my professional life, I've dealt with monetary issues, fiscal issues, but first of all, with institutions or institutional systems, for the simple reasons that large differences in this system are the most important determinant of large differences in the standard of living, broadly defined. And there are some interesting comparisons. There are countries like North and South Korea, which used to be equally poor in the 50s, and then North Korea has 7% of South Korean per capita income. Less drastic, but still, amazing differences have appeared between East and West Germany. Poland and Spain in 1950 have about the same per capita income. In 1990, we have only 42%. So what is behind these huge differences which appeared in a relatively short time? It is not location, it is not climate, it is not culture in the sense of informal norms. First of all, there are huge differences in institutional systems. And this is why studying these differences, studying these systems and their impact upon standard of living and studying the changes, it's one of the most important subjects in social sciences. And I think still it is under research. Now, I start with this two stylized facts regarding the transition. Transition regarding the dynamics of systems. The dynamic of a system depends on its nature. And I would oppose, I would contrast two kinds of a system. The one which have a real life manifestation, I'm coming to this, it's called social communism, was characterized by the total concentration of power, political power. And it could be foreseen it produced very bad economic results. But it has lasted. The Soviet Union has lasted for 7 to 8 years. So why it has lasted? Naive question. It has lasted because of intimidation. And intimidation can work over even the longer time, despite very bad economic and other outcomes. So this is like an example of a very bad system on all the possible measures, including bad standard of living, but also fear vis-a-vis the state. Contrast this with a system when power is well dispersed, which presumes freedom rights, well protected. Call it free market economy plus rule of law regime. We know from vast experience that these systems tend to perform much better. Does it guarantee that they last? Is superior economic performance a sufficient conditions for these superior system to last? Not necessarily. They are not threatened from outside. They are threatened from inside by various interest groups. Anti-liberal or anti-freedom interest groups, we know from vast literature and history that they may be divided into a commercial one, but they are also very aggressive, ideological, anti-freedom interest group. We can undermine the system. It turned it into the worst one. And we are watching it now in some countries. Of course, the conclusion is defend. Bad things cannot defend themselves. Good ideas require very good and massive communication. Without that, they would lose in the society. Now, this is a more extended typology of institutional systems. I think you need at least four dimensions along to show the differences. And I start with something which is called socialism. Other people prefer the word communism. The essence is the same. The primary feature is a total elimination of economic freedom by replacing private ownership by the monopoly of state ownership and markets by central planning or commands and rationing. Now, despite many, many illusions which existed in 19th century, 20th century, and they persist to this day, this system cannot perform otherwise than very bad. So it produces bad results. But it's not sufficient for this system to collapse immediately because of, as I mentioned, intimidation. So what would be the most important institution of such a system? Political police. KGB in Soviet Union and its counterparts in other countries, which thought there is no room for liberty rights, meaning civil rights, no economic freedom. There is some room for social rights because dictators like to distribute money and to be popular. Of course, there is no room for democracy in the sense of competitive elections because opposition is deprived of existence and under threat of criminal and other punishment. And we still have real-life counterparts of these systems like North Korea or Cuba, and they are not supported from outside very much. They still exist because of internal structures. Now, contrast this system, as I said, with the well-dispersed political power, and then you come to the conclusion which may be very obvious, but still worth repeating and remembering, that the best system which perform better on economy may persist, and bad economic performance is not sufficient to bring immediate collapse, even though it contributed. It contributed in real history without a growing economic weakness in the former Soviet Union. Probably there would not be Gorbachev reforms. He played a very important and positive role in dismantling the system, according, I think, to his, contrary to his initial intentions. But it's a positive for freedom. And I think in Poland's transition in 1989, after Solidarity Movement was suppressed at the end of 81, if not for growing political economic weakness, there would be less willingness for then communist authorities to negotiate with Solidarity Movement, which resulted in the beginning of Poland's transition. But let me come to the small developed typology of the systems, and I would like to draw your attention, first of all, I characterize socialism or communism. Let me only make one digression. I've noticed that some people are in love with the word socialism. And for them, socialism cannot denote anything bad. It has to be good. So they say, socialism did not exist in the former Soviet Union. It was not socialism. So what was socialism? Then they imply that socialism is defined by a large welfare state. This is the implicit definition of socialism. But if this is the definition, manipulated definition of socialism, this is something I will combat, then all the Western economies are already socialist, including the United States. It is a cliche that US does not have welfare state. Look at the data. US, the percentage of social transfers as a percentage of GDP in the US is higher than in Switzerland. It's higher than, slightly larger than in Canada. So according to this manipulative definition, all the Western countries have already socialists, which shows, of course, that this is an absurd definition. So we have to stick the original one, meaning total socialism, total concentration of political power, including power of the economy, which requires dictatorship, unavoidably. Democratic socialism is a misnomer. Now, it happens that the bad systems collapse, even though it is extremely difficult to foretell. I don't know anybody who have foretold exact timing and way in which the Soviet Union dissolved. We started a bit earlier, but still it was unexpected. But instead of trying to forecast what is very difficult to foresee, it's better to prepare, meaning prepare blueprints for the window of opportunity so that you are ready and do not need to completely improvise. And such a collapse happened, fortunately, between 89 and 91 in the former Soviet Union. In Poland, we started earlier. And then we have a living laboratory. I am coming now what one can call good transition from the point of view of Western standards. Rule of law, economic freedom, civil freedom, etc., etc. So initially, it seemed that all the countries of the former Soviet bloc were heading in the same direction, bringing these Western fundamentals. But then the transitions have diverged. And I show you a few data, if I can. Freedom of the press, generally speaking, at least until recently, Central and Eastern Europe countries have achieved Western levels, or also Western levels, but if you look at Belarus or Russia, then you see that this level of the freedom or unfreedom is more or less like in China or Cuba. Rule of law is measured by the World Bank, I think. Huge. The green, the higher, the better. Also huge, the huge differences. Civil liberties, the same story. Quite a differentiation. Private sector share has increased everywhere, but to the unequal level. And let me make also one additional comment. What matters for the economy is, of course, the share of the private sector, but there is a second dimension, how well it is protected. The best solution is high level of the private sector and equally and well protected. The opposite, there is a high level of the private sector which is badly protected in some so-called failed states. And the third variant, if you have pretty high level of the private sector, but very unequally protected, and this is oligarchic capitalism, like the one which originated in Russia. So you have a privileged groups of businessmen, which enjoy all the privileges, including the possibility to take over the assets of less privileged businessmen. Needless to say, this is not a good model, both from the point of view of fairness and from the point of view of economic growth. And there is no surprise that Russian economy under Putin is performing rather badly. Okay. So we have trade openness has increased everywhere, but to unequal extent and for different reasons. In case of Russia, it is mostly based on exports of raw materials. In case of Central and Eastern Europe, which are fortunate not to have abundant raw materials, it is based on exports of more processed goods. Notice, by the way, how close is Brazil. Very close economy. Turkey is much more close than Poland, for example. And this opening have played, opening to the West, has played a very important role in economic performance. Now there's a huge literature which analyzes the differences in the economic performance of the post-socialist countries. I am not going into it, but let me only note that there are huge differences in the most important synthetic indicator, which is GDP growth. Ukraine is probably underestimated, certainly is underestimated, but still, it's a huge difference between Poland and present-day Ukraine, even though we were about the same per capita income. Ukraine is now catching up. It's very important that they are successful. So what would be the general transition? Very unequal as far as changes are concerned, especially in a political system. Secondly, democracy was maintained, at least until recently, in countries which introduced capitalism. And this confirms the former experience that no capitalism or market, private market economy, no lasting democracy. For the simple reason that if you control the economy, you control politics, or you may control politics. It's very nice. And also, say, if you imagine that you start with the combination of open political competition plus socialist economy, then after a while, this economy will perform badly, and some people would try to change it by moving to a market economy, and then it would be either banned. This would be the end of democracy, or they would be allowed, and this would be the end of socialism. So this is unstable combination. Now that all the countries which have moved very little on the economy return to dictatorships, like Belarus and Central Asia, but there are also some quasi-capitalist economies like Russia, which proves that you may have a combination of more or less market economy and no democracy, like it's present day in China. But it's a huge mistake to generalize from Chinese example and say, look, this is a successful model. Because 99% are very bad dictatorship, or 90% are very bad economically. Okay, now let me come to the last part of my introduction, which are recent authoritarian transitions. What I meant by that, if the after free elections, this is not because of the coup d'etat, after free elections, and they could be divided into three blocks. The first is, what does it mean a complete authoritarian transition? It means that opposition cannot win elections because it's so limited by laws or by the practical operation of the state apparatus that it cannot win. There are some cases of democratically reversed transitions, bad transitions, including Macedonia. And finally, in Poland, our transition is incomplete, and it can go both ways. It seems to me that the likelihood of reverting to a democratic system, fully democratic system, is increasing in Poland. But I cannot discuss that. Now, I think there is too much generalizations about various bad transitions. There is no one uniting reason for various bad transitions, and there are differences among them. I think the first step in analyzing the various cases has to be distinguish how did it happen that the political party or group have won elections, which then tries to introduce an authoritarian transition, has won elections. And secondly, if you want to eliminate democratic competition, what do you do? On the first, this is these two questions which I have asked in my presentation. And again, I think one should, as I said, I give an example. Bad transitions have started under good economic situation and under bad economic situation. So bad economic situation is not the only reason why bad transition may start. One should not underestimate factors which did not need to happen but did happen. We call it usually shocks in economy. So let me give the example of Polish case. Unexpected victory, not so much parliamentary victory, but presidential victory of the now ruling party in 2015. What were these reasons which did not need to happen? Very bad electoral campaign of the then incumbent president, and surprisingly good election campaign of the present president, despite the fact that the latter has presented a very bad program, but very attractive in technical terms. So one just cannot underestimate the importance of the technical quality of election campaigns in massive democracies. You have to be very good in a massive democracy to beat the opponent with a bad program. And bad programs, like sometimes, are easier to sell. And secondly, in the parliamentary elections, there were two parties which barely missed on the opposition side, which barely missed a threshold. And this was sufficient for the parliamentary victory of the present ruling party, which is in Polish called PiS. Now let me come to once a group which wants to perpetuate itself in power achieves electoral victory, they have at disposal three instruments. The first one is clientelism or economic populism. That's typical for some Latin American countries, which then spread. So buying support, first by transfers from the budget, and secondly, by distributing jobs. And the more state organization you have, the more jobs you can distribute. And you may nationalize. So increase this possibility. Secondly, this political propaganda by the media, including the capture media. And they may be very, very aggressive and very brutal. And this, in addition, we would have social media. So possibilities have increased. And again, you have to be on the social media to beat populists. And the third, which is the most dangerous, which is taking over the state apparatus, including the potentially repressive parts, like police, prosecutors, judges. Judges are not repressive, but this is the ultimate defense of rule of law, to intimidate. And if this instrument is used in a strong way, the bad regime may persist for some time, at least. And the fourth factor, after the victory of authoritarians, is what is the economic situation? In every country, improved economic situation convinces many people that the rulers are okay, including the US, I think. And if it happens, then for a time being, it strengthens the Trump popularity of the authoritarian group. This happened until recently in Poland. This happened before in Russia. Putin has won when Russia was at the bottom. And then anybody who governed later would be popular for some time. Oil prices have been increasing, and he's been using this increased popularity to tighten the control until the moment where opposition cannot win election. Control. So I would say that windfall gains or good luck for bad people is very dangerous for a country, but you cannot control this situation. It happens. Then you, again, you have to be better on mobilization and on communication. And the last observation, if you look at the whole group of recent authoritarian transitions, including Erdogan, President Erdogan in Turkey, Putin, which I mentioned, to some extent Orbán in Hungary and our government in Poland, you see that there are no free marketeers. They are economic populists. It's not always like that. For example, Deng Xiaoping was a liberal because he was enlarging economic freedom. But what is typical of this group, recent cases, is they are populist in a sense that they tend to use the budget for political purposes, and they try to control the supply side of the economy, so reduce economic freedom. Now, this is a brief overview of what's happening in Poland. It's extremely important that the justice system, especially the criminal justice system, remains independent from politicians, including the ruling politicians. Once it is controlled, sooner or later, democracy is finished because using, or rather misusing, the justice system, the authoritarians can reduce the possibility of the opposition in such a way that they cannot win elections. Look what is happening to Alexei Navalny in Putin's Russia, a very brave man. He's been many times arrested. His foundation has been under control, political and policy control, so that even though the dissatisfaction with the government in Russia is growing, so far opposition is incapable of winning elections, but it's very important they continue. So this is what happened in Poland, including, and this corresponds with this triad I mentioned, which is clientelism or economic populism, capturing the media, the state media, which should be privatized before, because they are then easy to capture if they are state-owned. On the economy, the growth has accelerated during the last 3 or 4 years, but it has nothing to do with the policy during this period. It's first of all due to acceleration of economic growth in the European Union, which comes to an end now, and a doubling of the inflows of Ukrainian workers, which come to Poland, and this is specific to Poland. And it's not completely clear that it will continue, but because of this and acceleration of structural changes, meaning, among other things, that more peasants migrate from villages to cities and increase their productivity. And this has boosted economic growth, has boosted the tax revenues, and created possibilities for more spending, which was used, as I said, for political purposes. But at the same time, the supply side of the economy has suffered. And I think very important indicator is what is happening to the investment ratio. Despite the promises that investment would increase, which is very important for Poland, has visibly declined. And there is no other explanation as that the reason was the increased level, perceived level of risk, political risk in Poland. These are some other indicators. The deficits have not exploded, largely because there were increased tax revenues, which then the increase was spent on extra programs. But the situation in the public finance remains fragile. And finally, what is, I think, most worrisome is the expanding state sector. Even before before 2016, we have still a larger dose of state-owned enterprises, and the share has increased in two very important sectors, which is banking sector and energy sector. So this is an implementation of old-fashioned policy of commanding heights. This is the summary. Well, what we are facing for various reasons, not only domestic reasons, but first of all, external environment, the growth will be slower, and the order started to fall. And civic society is, and this is a very important part, is growing in Poland. So I left to the discussion the questions, what about the next in Poland, so that I promise to speak for no more than 25 minutes.
Very good.
Thank you.
We do have time for questions. If you have a question, please raise your hand and wait for the microphone and identify yourself and your affiliation. Do we have any questions? We have one question here. We need a microphone, please. Up here. Thank you. Right, could you raise your hand, please? Thank you.
Thank you. I would like just for you, if you could state...
Could you identify yourself and your affiliation, please?
Archibald Hamilton. I'm a researcher. Mm-hmm. So I would like the author, if he can identify two different cases for study. A democracy where populism has been studied, and a dictatorship where populism manifested.
Do you understand that?
If there is some kind of case you have seen throughout your research,
I'm not quite sure. I understand the question. Could you repeat it, please?
Where populism can be studied in two different systems, in dictatorship and in democracy.
You want examples of populism under dictatorship and populism under democracy?
Yeah, if you have some.
Well, you have to start with the definition of populism, because not everything is populist, and populist does not necessarily mean popular. The classical definition of economic populists stems from Latin America, Rudy Dornbusch. This is the policy of fiscal stimulation, which brings about, if it continues, a fiscal collapse. At the same time, usually it goes hand in hand with damaging the supply side by by increasing politicization. So in this sense, we have some manifestations of populism in the countries I have mentioned. After these authoritarian cases of after free elections. You may speak of populism when you make a very exaggerated cases about immigration. And you present immigrants as evils. So you appeal to very negative emotions. So I would say this is an anti-immigration populism. And this has happened in Poland, unfortunately, recently.
Yes. Question on the aisle there.
Jan Hosler, political researcher. I'm very interested in the EU expanding into the countries that were formerly under the Soviet Union. Especially, we know that Ukraine has had a request in with the EU for several years, since 2015, I believe. What's the chances that the EU will be expanding into the area formerly under Soviet control?
Mm-hmm. Ukraine has concluded a couple of years ago a comprehensive association agreement with European Union, which brought about some opening of the markets of Ukrainian products. It was associated also with certain conditions regarding reforms, eradication of corruption, etc., etc. I think these agreements are beneficial to Ukraine. I don't think it is very likely that in the coming years Ukraine would be admitted to the European Union. The chances are the greater, the more successful is Ukraine. So domestic reforms are the key. And I can only say that the new administration in Ukraine has made some promising measures, which were not done before. For example, the promise to end the moratorium of the privatization of land. I think it goes in the right direction.
What are the countries in Europe that most concern you in terms of the rise of populism or even nationalism?
Well, of course, I am concerned about my own country, and this is why I'm active.
Yeah.
In the European Union, I think Italy, because of the economy and of the political situation. And why Italy matters, because it's a large country, and also a potential crisis, economic crisis in Ukraine, would be dangerous to the Eurozone. Even Greece was dangerous to the stability. But if there is a large country like Italy, that would be quite a big risk.
Yeah. Yes, question in the aisle there. Question in the aisle. Could you raise your hand? Thank you.
David Brazil, I'm an economist. You characterized Hungary as an example of authoritarian transition. Can you expand on that somewhat?
Well, I am basing my...
Why you characterize it as such?
Well, first of all, I try to read the massive literature on what is happening in Hungary, and I have some friends which have first-hand knowledge about Ukrainian transitions. What are the components of the capture? It is, first of all, justice system, as I mentioned. And to my knowledge, the justice system is not completely independent, to say the least. And without that, it's very difficult to expect a fair political competition, which we call genuine democracy. The difference between Hungary and Poland, one of the differences is that so far, fortunately, the present regime does not aim of creating its own oligarchs. They rather aim at expanding the state sector and to distribute jobs. While in Hungary, judging for what can read from reputed reports, they have their, Orban has the, its own, his own favorite oligarchs who tend to win, for example, to get government contracts.
Yeah, right here.
Jim Dorn, glad to see you again. Welcome to Cato again. I've always liked your emphasis on the institutional arrangements and how important they are in terms of economic development and economic freedom. And when you look around the world now, you see what's going on, for example, in Hong Kong, Chile, Peru even, other countries, which have had track records for a long time in terms of making progress in terms of rule of law and so on. And things seem to be changing overnight. And I was wondering what your impression of that is and what the best defense against that type of change is.
Well, I think what is going on in Chile is a confirmation that good model, meaning lots of freedom, economic growth, etc., needs defenses. Because it's not enough to be economically successful to prevail. I am not an expert on Chile. I benefited from the conversation. I am, and it seemed to me that in Chile you have a well-organized groups which are motivated by anti-capitalistic or anti-liberal propaganda, which are not facing enough resistance in the form of communication and appealing to the people, to the masses of people who, compared to what is happening, has been happening in the most of Latin America countries, have hugely benefited. So one cannot overestimate the role of organized defense of good solutions, including communication. This is why I'm so happy to be always in Cato, to be guest of Cato. We don't have a battle of ideas. It sounds very good. Because we know more or less which ideas are destructive and which ideas, if implemented, are productive. We have a battle of communication. And bad people can win the battle of communication. So we have to be better. That's it.
Yes.
Samar Chatterjee, Safe Foundation. Thank you, sir, for taking all this data on democracy and capitalism and dictatorship all over the world to make some sense out of it. And I don't know whether that is. Now, a lot of these things are made on judgment. Now, I'll use two examples to ask you a question. United States, I came to United States in 1970. I thought in those days, United States was a lot freer, a lot better in terms of opportunities and so on. It has deteriorated substantially today. And it's heading towards what probably, in my opinion, what Soviet Union was as a dictatorship. However, the Soviet Union in those days has turned out to be, it collapsed and became some kind of a quasi-democracy or something. You said Putin was using the oil money to make changes. So given that Russia had gone in the reverse direction, are we talking about just people getting bored with one system and making changes and then finding out that that doesn't work and then again another system is caused? I mean, this is really, in my opinion, to me, dictatorship or democracy, if they are good for the people, it always works. And after all, the Soviet Union with its dictatorship had stood against the United States and have done reasonably well, even though they were way behind in terms of economy and so on. And the United States has deteriorated. So are we talking about just these are kind of natural cycles that are going to go on? Or what is the situation in your opinion?
That's a huge question. But there are no cycles in history. There are irregularities and accidents and shocks. we cannot explain by any systematic theory, something which is largely unpredictable. I would not dare to comment on the US. There are enough people who live here. If I can only say something, that it's extremely important that US preserves its position as a model. And the model which US provided is, first of all, rule of law and economic freedom. And in any country, including the US, they may be subject to erosion. I am not predicting that. Certainly, I would not predict that US would end in the situation of USSR.
We can see that.
But, well, have you been to USSR?
No, no.
Ah, you see. So you don't compare. Don't compare. It's no comparison. No comparison. I can only say that when I compare the US with other cases and there are problems, I can see that certain key institutions are stronger. For example, when I read that President Trump appeals to the Supreme Court nowadays, yes, regarding whether he has to disclose that, this is the rule of law in operation. And there are some other key differences. But also in the US, there are tendencies for the erosion of economic freedom and anti-capitalistic propaganda. And this is an illustration, you can see, of pressure groups. They are not only businessmen who want to get some extra privileges. They are artists, intellectuals, who do not understand the essence of freedom. And among various freedoms, we can divide it, political, civil freedoms, the extremely important, fundamentally important freedom is economic freedom, property rights, etc., which are the most under attack in the West. It is not, fortunately, civil rights which are attacked. It's always economic freedom under various guises, and under various slogans, equality, ecology, etc. But it culminates, if its freedom is not defended, in its erosion. And then you may have a spiral. Economic freedom is limited. Economy starts to perform badly. And those who brought about this erosion call for more state intervention. So it has to be stopped earlier. And you can stop it by better communication.
So some countries are better positioned, maybe, like the United States, because of its strong institutions, to resist populist tendencies and populist politics, others not. How optimistic are you about Europe, Central Europe, the world, in terms?
I would not discuss the world. Europe is also too large.
Okay.
But it's tempting to generalize. But I think it's also important to see the differences. It is easy to focus on the problem cases when demagogia, propaganda seems to be successful. I think Britain, because Brexit was not, to my mind, based on merits, but on extremely demagogic propaganda, which may win. And we'll see how successful will be Britain. I mentioned Italy, which is a case of neglected reforms which lead to populism, and then one has to stop the spiral if possible. But I don't see erosion much threat to fundamentals of the liberal democracy in Germany, despite the rise of Alternative für Deutschland, but still, it's not very large. I don't see in Scandinavia any visible attacks on the fundamentals of liberal democracy. I mentioned Poland and Hungary. And Poland, I think, is a good chance, no certainty, that you will reverse it because of growth in the strength of the civil society. And I hope some expression of solidarity from more mature democracies. So situation is mixed. But what seems to be a common tendency across democratic world, that one neglects the importance of, repeat, economic freedom. It sounds so prosaic. And they, people don't understand how important it is for things they want, for economic growth and prosperity. And secondly, that is indispensable for well-functioning democracy. So I think it deserves a special attention to see, to look, to show to the people how important it is and how dangerous are these reductions or erosion in economic freedom. And I think we should take it for granted and work on that, that collectivist slogans are emotionally loaded. And before you start economic discussion, look at the language and undermine the populist language. The best by satire, ridicule, collectivist. This is why I'm trying to be in Poland via my Twitter and Facebook. Never accept the populist language, because if you accept, you are lost. And most of the language which is used by democrats, populists, emotionally loaded. And it influences emotions. It's not based on any... Why Marxism was so extremely successful? 19th century, it was very successful, not scientifically, even though it was called scientific, but politically. It was bad from the very beginning. It was absurd, because it was based on absurd assumption that the whole product should go to the worker. Otherwise, it's exploitation, so everybody is exploitation. It was flagrantly false. But why it's so successful? Because it was quasi-religion. Emotionally loaded. It indicated who are good guys, proletariat, not the workers. Now that they are looking for replacement for the workers, and they are called precariat. Then there were chosen people. This was the chosen people, bad people. You have to point out to the enemy. Who are the enemy? They used to be called bourgeois, but they continue to be enemies. They are called now what? Super rich, capitalists, etc., etc. This is based completely on emotions. And then you have to point out to the paradise. Paradise, socialism. Socialism was supposed to be paradise. And it worked. Because emotions work, and it's easier to produce negative, destructive emotions, destructive for the system based on freedom. So, but this is the fact of life, and the only reasonable response to be better. Absolutely. And to be better in using the social media.
Yeah. Yes, in the aisle there.
Thank you. Adrian Chauvel, retiree. You were interested, you were talking about institutions. One of the obviously critical thing is independence of the judiciary. And just thinking about it, is it easier to maintain an independent judiciary in a code law, in a common law system than in a code law system? Because of in the code law system, it is really essentially part of administrative structure. Any thoughts?
Well, I know there is a research on that. That you have independent judiciary in both systems. You have this independent in Germany, in Netherlands, in Scandinavia, and in Britain. So you don't need to fight for the common law, which is impossible to introduce. Fight the authoritarians. And then you are successful, because they want to capture the justice system in order to stifle the opposition.
Two questions there. First, the gentleman on the aisle.
Thank you. I'm Leon Weintraub, a retired member of the Foreign Service. You spoke in somewhat positive terms about the Scandinavian countries. You didn't see any threats coming from there. Those who often praise or speak highly of socialism for the United States often point to those countries as models. Are there specific things that we might learn from them, or do you see some problems that it's working there, but it wouldn't work here?
Those who mention Scandinavia as a model and live in the US, they don't know what they're speaking about. Because they present this as a paradise, without explaining why it is a paradise. But if you ask them, that probably they would say it is because of welfare state, large social spending, et cetera, et cetera. And this is why I've shown you that United States has already a large welfare state. So what else? They should be asked, what else you recommend in this model? And I don't think they can respond in a convincing way. Besides, even if you have something which is good in a country which has 5 million people, like Denmark, it's not enough to say, hey, let us introduce in the United States. And the third point, that in some respects, for example, Sweden, it's more, how to say, liberal in the European sense than the United States. In what respects? For example, education. To my knowledge, I've been following, Sweden is the country which introduced education bonds, private firms can compete for this voucher, education vouchers. What about the United States? I think teachers' union has been blocking these innovations. So ask them whether they like in Scandinavia the voucher systems, education voucher system, when they recommend Scandinavia. Well, unfortunately, and this is again something which is unavoidable but has to be resisted, reacted, politicians do not discuss modern physics. 80% they discuss economics. And 60% is a bullshit. They are slogans. They try to appeal to ignorance on emotions. And this way, again, it's absolutely essential to unmask in such a way it reaches the people. And the same goes, I think, with this model. Anything, it is very non-specific. What exactly is the Scandinavian model which has to be introduced in the United States?
Well, one specific item that is often mentioned is the elimination of the gross inequality of income.
Well, then, we enter a huge subject, but let me say, I think this most of the debate about inequality is based on confusion. First of all, I want to distinguish between inequality of opportunity and inequality of income. And regarding inequality of opportunity, we know what would be the ideal. Where should they go? To reduce it as much as possible. But what is the ideal inequality of income? Is it zero? Or is it highest income should be no more than 5 times low income? No, but it's impossible to tell. And third, one should not confuse income inequality with fighting poverty. One should fight poverty, elementary poverty. And there are some policies, including in rich countries, which enrich the rich without helping the poor. And they are very popular. For example, zoning, restrictive zoning in San Francisco or in London, it raises the prices of real estate. Who benefits? The rich. What about unconventional monetary policy, which is presented as a panacea for everything? I understand that according to some analysis, it tends to increase the prices of financial assets. Who benefits more? Richer people. So I think the reasonable discussion should focus on policies. And then with the idea to identifying and removing bad policies, such policies which enrich the rich without benefiting the poor. And usually there would be policies which also increase competition. So anti-monopolistic policy is one of those policies should be strengthened.
Right here.
Hello, my name is Letizia Zipperlin. I'm working for the Friedrich Naumann Foundation. Sure. My question is, since you pointed out that populism is increasing actually independent from the political system looking at, we're having problems in Italy, in Germany, in Chile, all over the world. And you said that the success of populism is probably mainly because of their way they communicate, because they have a very easy language. I wanted to ask you, what do you think do people who are in favor of democracy and equality and liberty, should they change their way of communicating? Should they be more emotional in discussions? Should they try to kind of relate to the language of people who want to bring populism forward?
Well, I say language matters. I am not encouraging defenders of freedom to be equally demagogic as those who want to destroy freedom. But they could be better without that, in unmasking demagogy. Unmasking, it can be done in such a way that it undercuts, to some extent, the demagogues. But let me also mention what would be one of the important general reasons why anti-market and collectivist communication tends to be successful. Because one of the cliches, I think, which is widely accepted, including mainstream economics, that whenever it is a crisis, it is due to free markets. So, how to save? You have to have an enlightened state intervention. It's accepted across mainstream economics, and as a result, across most of the media. And the recent financial crisis has strengthened this, because it has been taken for granted that it was the failure of free markets. Mm-hmm. And what was disregarded? Policies which contributed to the failure of distorted markets. So one should strengthen, I think, unmasking this prejudice, which underlies almost everything in communication. And the second one is inequality, which I tried to say. Inequality and capitalism means crisis. While if you define crisis as a radical deterioration of the economy, then when did you have examples of the most drastic crisis? Under Mao Zedong, a total collapse of the economy, and combined with genocides, Stalinism, Fidel Castro, not so drastic, but also collapse. What is the gravest danger? Concentration of political power, which leads to the possibilities or the risk that this political power will be used for absurd policies. Because by definition, if you have a total concentration of political power, you are not controlled. So I think the main problem in social sciences, including economics, is how to wisely disperse or divide political power, which is a classical problem, and then to defend this limited political power. So I think it underlies most of other problems.
I think you've answered the question partially that I'm going to ask, but that is, what are your priorities in terms of what you're doing with the Civil Development Forum as far as policy priorities or other priorities go for Poland?
The first priority is to contribute to the change in political power, meaning elections, free elections. And the coming elections, I'm not directly participating in the elections. I am not competing for any office. But I'm trying with my civil development former, Agata is managing it, to influence in a positive way the public opinion by unmasking my populism and lies. This is the first. As far as what I think is the most important in Poland, to restore the rule of law. Which means, in practice, depoliticizing institutions of the rule of law. This is in practice, starting with Constitutional Tribunal, which was occupied in an unconstitutional way. Prosecution, we discussed, I think, the dangers which are coming from prosecution to the rule of law and justice are under research. I am not speaking about misuse of plea bargaining in the US. I am speaking about the dangers once prosecution is being captured. And then you can harass your opponents and undermine the opposition. That's extremely important to look at. And then finally, the courts, which so far has defended themselves with the support of civil society. And then to reverse these anti-market measures like nationalizations of the banks.
Well, I think that we have time for one more question, so we'll take one in the back there, please. Question in the back. Could you raise your hand, please? Thank you.
Thanks for this excellent talk. My name's Bob Gersoni. I'm a retiree also. And I wonder, do you have some examples of political figures or institutions that are effectively rising to the defense of the values that you're advocating?
You mean, I know Poland the best. And we have many lawyers who defend the independence of the courts. We have an association of independent prosecutors who criticize the present prosecution, and they take certain risk. We have created an association, a sort of a forum for the coordination of think tanks in Poland, including the think tank I have created some years ago, to operate better, to coordinate the defense of the independence of the rule of law. So these are the examples. What counts really? Organization and communication. And one can do it.
What about businesses and entrepreneurs? Where do they stand?
Each individual entrepreneur is afraid. And to some extent, he's correct, because under the regime which can use or misuse, for example, tax administration, why should you risk your business? But what can be done, I think, is more action on the part of association of business. Mm-hmm. They are trying to do, but still too much. They like to be polite vis-a-vis authoritarians. But let me mention that we have foreign investors, including from America, and they behave in such a way as to appease. They could do more via their associations. We have Chamber of American Investors, German, etc. And some years ago, I think 3 or 4 years ago, I invited them and told them, look, each of them may be vulnerable. But what about common defense? Why don't you create a chapter? This you expect the authorities to respect these rules. They were very happy about the proposal and did nothing, which is the problem of collective action.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. Your challenge there in Poland is a challenge of so many people who are trying to achieve the same things all around the world. And so your talk was very useful to us, and I'm sure to people who are listening online and here in the audience today. So please join me in thanking Leszek Balcerowicz for his comments.